If nature's forms and systems express a purpose, then we must doubt our absolute suzerainty over nature. We must doubt the assumption that we can engineer nature endlessly with impunity, especially when we do so in ignorance of its purposes. In a blind, purposeless universe, we are at perfect liberty to do our will, for there is no natural order on which we might infringe, no destiny to interfere in, no destiny at all, in fact, except that which we create. But if there is a purpose inherent in the way of the world, then the whole bent of science must change from understanding for control's sake to understanding for the sake of according more closely to nature's purpose. Asking of ourselves, what are we for? We will seek out our proper role and function on the planet and in the universe. This transition, which I believe will inevitably flow from the new scientific paradigms described herein, represents our abdication from the pretense to lordship over nature to become nature's humble student. Observing nature through our cultural lenses of separation, competition, and survival anxiety, we have long been blind to the fact that nature doesn't always work that way. Nonetheless, evidence for the non-randomness of genetic change is mounting. It is now widely accepted that the rates of genetic mutation increase when organisms are under stress, presumably to increase the likelihood of a mutation that will arise that is better adapted to the stressor. Reflecting consensus, a recent article in Nature opines, quote, "It makes sense for stress responses to cause mutations. It may be a selected feature that increases genetic variation, thus increasing evolvability under stress when organisms are suboptimally adapted to their environments. Most of the mutations would be harmful or neutral, but rare adaptive mutations would also occur." Close quote. Recent research implies that this stress can be the quite common occurrence of running low on food, implying that accelerated mutation is an ordinary feature of bacterial life. Even though such mutations are thought to still be random, stress-induced mutagenesis is immensely problematic to the standard selfish gene theory. The unit of selection is supposed to be the gene, not the organism. Genetic characteristics, such as mutability, that benefit the organism in a way that does not promote the gene's replication in future generations, would be selected against. More controversial by far is a concept sometimes called adaptive mutation that has cropped up intermittently in biology under various guises ever since the days of Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. Reintroduced in 1988 by John Cairns, it claims that mutations are not fully random, but are somehow biased toward an adaptive purpose. Cairns disabled a gene in E. coli that produces an enzyme to digest lactose, then put the E. coli in a lactose-only medium. To his surprise, the disabled gene mutated back to the original enzyme-producing version, not in every bacteria, but at a higher rate than in a control culture where the bacteria had food sources other than lactose. While the consensus is that an overall elevated but still random stress-induced mutation rate can explain this finding, other research supports the idea that it may be truly adaptive. B.G. Hall found that a similar E. coli mutation happened to permit utilization of the sugar arbutin in the presence of starvation, but only when there was arbutin in the medium. The mutation happened at a much higher rate specifically when it was useful. Other research has found that increased mutation rates under stress are not evenly distributed across the genome, but are much higher in precisely those areas which may generate beneficial mutations. The controversy rages on today, with orthodox opinion maintaining that stress-induced hypermutability can fully explain adaptive mutation and thus preserve Darwinianism. There are several reasons for the mainstream aversion to true adaptive mutation. Some commentators seem to feel it would entail spooky foreknowledge of what mutations would be useful. Personally, I am a fan of spooky foreknowledge, but in the case of adaptive mutation, it is unnecessary. All that is needed is a way for the DNA to sense and internalize signals from the environment. In other words, a way for the environment to speak to the DNA, to alter it purposefully, just as the DNA, mediated by the organism, alters the environment. Adaptive mutation implies a tight coupling between gene and environment that calls into question the very definition of the biological self. To say that the gene responds to the environment is a conceit. Just as easily, we could say that the environment molds the gene. The precise mechanisms by which this happens are unknown and mostly unexplored, due to the widespread belief that nature doesn't work that way. Nonetheless, there are several confirmed examples already, along with some interesting speculation. Mainstream biology has long accepted that reverse transcriptase allows RNA to rewrite DNA, and that antibodies in immune cells help to modify the DNA that produces them. More radical, but also now widely accepted, is the observation that epigenetic proteins, which envelop the DNA double helix, also carry heritable information that affects the way genes are expressed. What's more, these epigenetic proteins are also subject to heritable environmental modification. More radical still are proposals that invoke electromagnetic or other vibrational induction of genetic change. Finally, I must mention John Joe McFadden's very clever effort to bring spooky foreknowledge back into evolution through the quantum Zeno effect. His full argument is beyond the scope of the present chapter, but essentially he believes that genes take advantage of quantum superpositions of states to scan the search of space of possible mutations whose viability is confirmed by the observer effect of their own progeny. Whatever the mechanism, evidence is mounting that the environment influences genes through mechanisms beyond mere natural selection. The evidence has been mounting, in fact, for a long time, as Charles Darwin, himself remarkably free of the dogma of Darwinism, acknowledged in 1888. Quote, "In my opinion, the greatest error which I have committed has not been allowing sufficient weight to the direct action of the environments, food, climate, etc., independently of natural selection. When I wrote The Origin, and for some years afterwards, I could find little good evidence of the direct action of the environment. Now there is a large body of evidence." Close quote. If Darwin was aware of it in 1888, why do most biologists still ignore this good evidence today? Indeed, the evidence today is far greater. The institutional insistence on the primacy of the DNA as the controller program for morphology and behavior, and on the randomness of its evolution that is driven solely by natural selection, derives not from the evidence, but from deeper cultural assumptions about who we are. The challenge that adaptive mutation presents strikes at the heart of our culture's dualistic conception of world and self. Purpose, once the sole province of the conscious self of psychology, or at least the sentient self of biology, escapes the confines of individual actors, purposers, to become a property of the world as a whole. No longer do the genes necessarily act in their own self-interest, nor even, as we shall see, the selfish interest of the organism they are part of. Rather than being the source of purpose, which is only to survive, they are a means by which organism and environment enact purpose. In that case, in what sense are the genes the kernel of biological selfhood? Yes, they carry heritable instructions for building bodies, but it is outside signals that activate them. Nor are these instructions inviolable. They are readily modified according to need. Wouldn't that which modifies them be a more appropriate choice for selfhood? Our Cartesian intuitions tell us that ultimate authority must reside somewhere, but the invoker or modifier is not a discrete entity either. It is the cell, the organism, even the environment. The self is no longer so rigidly defined. Therefore, neither is self-interest. Who are we? The question has no definite answer. Different answers are expedient for different purposes, but none is complete. Natural selection depends for its primacy on a discrete self to act on, but we are now learning that the self of biology, the subject of natural selection, is not discrete but fluid, merging by degrees into the genetic plenum. Direct evidence for adaptive mutation is still ambiguous. However, if natural selection on random mutations of replicating DNA is not the prime mover of evolution, then we must construct a coherent understanding of life, its origins, and its evolution that does not rely on competition among discrete genetic subjects. Fortunately, just such a story is emerging today and gradually infiltrating mainstream biology. It is a story in which cooperation, just as much as competition, defines relationships among living beings, in which symbiosis and merger across fluid genetic boundaries drive evolution, and in which purpose arises from both within the organism and without. No longer is biology a study of separate and competing cells, and no longer will that idea inform our intuitions about the way of the world.
Well, roll on the day when we can evolve our money system to be something other than a competition for scarce resources amongst discrete and separate selves. Back to the panel discussion. If you listen carefully, you'll pick up two contradictory tones, as well as the Darwinian-inspired reductionist approach, which says, well, epigenetics is like genetics, only it's another thing, and we're going to learn how to do it, and then we'll have the bigger picture. There is the impulse, which is that things should be fair, and that's why the scientists are trying to research it. Some of them want to cure the ills of poverty and give people the, quote, level playing field. But, of course, that's a nonsense in the Darwinian paradigm, which says, well, the fittest should survive and will survive, and that's how the world works. And I think this reflects the turmoil of science, which is undergoing a paradigm shift. I hope it's becoming less of a kind of Victorian-inspired justification for how to dominate the world, and more of a reflection of our higher human values, which I think are about love and not about domination. Do we really need to have all these complex experiments to tell us that it's a good thing to be good? And this is a point that the host picks up on.
So why are we having this conversation, and why are you spending so much of your time looking at this question, Mike, of epigenetics that you raised for us, that in fact, a lot of the things that we would have been having conversations about 20 and 30 years ago, like poverty and education, that in fact we know now that if you go in and take samples from those people who are having those experiences, they differ under the skin at a biological level. Why is that important, and what are some of the implications of that?
I'm really most excited about it really filling a gap in knowledge, touching that curiosity that I always had on how these things happen, and offering an opportunity to really satisfy that curiosity and mechanistically understand how experiences get under the skin in a lasting fashion. That's really what I think is the new aspect of this. And the fact that we can determine both the factors that ultimately lead to these epigenetic marks, but also the consequences of these epigenetic marks as they vary in the population.
How about you, Clyde?
For me, understanding human plasticity, understanding the mix of things that are sort of determined versus things that are malleable according to environments and how environments and biologies work together is interesting in and of itself. And it's interesting also because I think the more that we understand about that, that we may end up redefining the way we think about how we organize societies in a different way. You know, for instance, just taking on, you know, what Tom was talking about the orchid versus the dandelion children, like it would be a very different way to look at society is to say, you know, we have some subsets of our population that are like bellwethers, right? And we now understand through a variety of very careful documentations that, you know, those kids really are bellwethers in the sense that if they do well, it's an indicator that we are doing well as a society. If they're doing poorly, it's an indicator that we're doing poorly as a society. So a different way of judging ourselves, yeah. Right? And a different way of holding things accountable. I mean, part of the reason to look at the world developmentally is that we stop the perversions. One of the things that we do here in Vancouver is that we take standardized school test scores and use them to say that the schools that have high scores are good schools and the schools that have low scores are bad schools. Well, understanding anything about development will tell you that's not so. That in fact, unless you take into account the state that the kids come into the school and the context in which the kids are growing up, you can't judge those test results. And in fact, I know in Vancouver, some of the schools with some of the lowest results on those standardized tests, actually, when you look at the state that kids came into the school developmentally and the context in which they're looking in, that they're actually doing way better than you'd predict. So the idea of, in a sense, learning more about human development, and particularly the early aspects of human development, and allowing that to become a guide to how we judge ourselves and how we organize society seems to me in a diffuse way to have potential benefits that could go forward into the future.
Yeah, it seems to me, how can you respond to someone's need if you don't really understand what the need is? So just as an outsider listening to you, the hope I see here is that for my child or any of our children who have some medical condition, for example, we would, the more we know about that medical condition, the more we can meet their needs, right? So you're telling me that you could give me more information about individual children and groups of children that maybe would help an educator, a healthcare provider meet those children's needs better. That seems logical to me.
The reason that a child growing up in a community or a family that is disadvantaged has a shorter lifespan, has a greater likelihood of developing a chronic medical disease, has a greater likelihood of becoming psychiatrically impaired, that is at the moment at least a partial mystery. And that's what we were talking about earlier. But I don't think it will always be a mystery. And I'm convinced, from having taken care of families from very wealthy families to very poor families, that the vast, vast majority of parents from all different strata of the society want the best for their children and they want to be good parents. And the reality is that at the moment, we don't know how to tell them to be good parents. And let me give you an example. One of the things that we know is a difference between professional families and working class families is that a child growing up in a working class family by the age of 3 hears 30 million fewer words than a child growing up in a professional family. Now there is a candidate mundane difference between families of different social class. And we have reason now to believe, and there's a certain amount of evidence, that that difference in exposure, simple exposure to language, may have causative repercussions in terms of brain development, changing the circuitry of the brain. The only way that we're really going to be able to figure out what are the ways that we need to change the experience of low SES children is to really understand at a fundamental biological level what is happening, how these epigenetic effects actually take place, and what are the environmental factors that are related to them.
Yeah, because one of the things is, especially when you start to make the argument that it's not only that child who's affected by that adversity, but their children who are affected by that adversity and their children's children. Mm-hmm. Then there's this trajectory that to me sounds like it's just written in stone. Nobody gets a chance to break that drive. So my question would be, if you can turn the dimmer switch on and off with these genes. And I know that's really simplistic, Mike, but that's why I kind of hear you talking about it. In one direction that makes them suffer in the world, could you not, if you understood the mechanism better, get in early and do something to reverse it, to turn the switch the other direction?
Well, the tremendously hopeful flip side, if you will, of the rat experiments that Michael Meany and Moishe Shiff and their students have done in recent years is that not only are there effects that cross generations that put those generations of rats at risk, but the implication is that if you could change the experience of a single generation, at least in theory, one might be able to change the experiences of subsequent generations as well. So the tremendously, maybe even overly optimistic hope of this new science is the possibility that if we could do something to change the experience of a single generation, we might have effects that would echo on down into future generations.
So it's changing the environment and changing the experience that would then have this epigenetic effect. Mike, is that right?
Yes, I think that's certainly one of the exciting possibilities, although one needs to be honest that this is a dream at this point that we're all dreaming. But there are more immediate benefits, if you wish, that I can see. For example, we're working with Joanne Weinberg on fetal alcohol syndrome, which is a serious problem of in society, yet there isn't really an early diagnosis. And so the goal here is it's already known that maternal drinking affects the epigenome of the offspring. If we can develop early detection tests to then basically identify kids at risk for developing fetal alcohol spectrum disorder much, much earlier than currently, then we can intervene earlier and perhaps prevent a lot of the damage that could arise during a lifetime. So to me, that's a more immediate task, which is kind of in line with what Tom is saying, basically reversing.
How would you tell if they were at risk of fetal alcohol syndrome?
Well, if you could identify a epigenetic signature very early, right after birth, when there is no evidence whatsoever that they might develop fetal alcohol syndrome, because, you know, moms probably won't admit that they drank during pregnancy easily, or they're given up for adoption and things like that. So if we could pinpoint very early on the epigenetic signature of this particular kid predicts that they will develop fetal alcohol spectrum disorder later in life, I think that's a tremendous opportunity for society to basically provide early on behavioral therapies, whatever you want to, as you said, to switch that dimmer back to a more normal state.
And that's one example. There could be many of that.
Yeah, I think there are many of those, and in fact, it's already known that many of these effects can be reversed. I think, to me, the opportunity of epigenetics really lies also in the plasticity of it.
What do you mean by that?
I think it's dangerous to assume that these things are static and will never change.
Yeah,
one very germane issue that we ought to be considering right now is the following. The federal government set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission for people who have been in residential schools. The idea of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is that it's supposed to be dealing with those who were in the schools, not the succeeding generations. Mm. The question I suppose I would ask the whole audience is, should the Truth and Reconciliation Commission have a brief about epigenetics and the possibility of intergenerational transmission? And therefore, is it fair, or is it reasonable, or is it sensible in any way that a TRC only deal with the direct clients of the residential school? Or should we be thinking that in the absence of any other attempts to do anything, that if we'd like low licking and suckling environment that was provided for Aboriginal children from the 1890s right through to the 1960s may be persisting in various ways in following generations.
Yeah. It does put a whole new light on what is happening in that next generation for sure. It could, I should say.
Yes.
All right, let's take some questions. And
in the first question, which was off mic, someone asked whether the tests that have been done of famous people, politicians and rock stars and ordinary people that have found toxic chemicals in everyone's bloodstream, whether these chemicals are affecting the genetic makeup or behavior of people.
you know, you're right about the first observation, right? It's true about us. It's true about polar bears. It's true about, you know, every biological creature that is exposed to the modern world. There is a lot of work going on what the epigenetic contributions of those might be. For a long time, there's been a lot of interest in the role that, you know, chemical exposures play, for instance, in relation to certain kinds of cancers. And so a lot of that work is carrying on in that direction. To be honest with you, I used to be in that field 15 or 20 years ago, and I'm not in it so much these days, so I'm not following it as closely as I could be. But the answer to that is that there is research going on in that area.
So I'm going to come as close as I can with the microphone, but because I think it's probably better for our listening audience if we use the microphone. Did somebody else want to respond to that?
Well, I think actually I see Bruce up there in the audience. I think there is actually evidence that certain chemicals can affect the epigenetic modifications, but certainly that's again at a stage where we're just charting the landscape, and there needs to be much more work to really understand the functional consequences and the lasting effects of those chemicals. In other words, for example, if you're exposed transiently to a chemical, how long, if it affects the epigenome, how long does that last, even say the chemical is removed? So those are some of the interesting questions that folks are working on.
We have another question here.
Well, it's actually a comment. I'm Métis, and I've worked for the past 20 years with residential school survivors. And I was very interested in what you said, because we know absolutely in our communities that the effects of residential school go on for at least 3 generations. So I think people would be very happy to receive your information. It would sort of confirm from another angle our own experience. We believe that it goes at least to the grandchildren and often to the great-grandchildren. So I don't know how that fits with your scientific information. I came in late, I'm sorry. But definitely we know that in our working experience, and I'm sure what you have to say would be welcomed and accepted in the community. So thank you for your comments. But I'm curious, how long do you think it goes on?
Well, you know, that's the very good question. And it's a trick, okay? We have this highly politicized commission that's going on right now, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, on the one hand. And on the other hand, we have this understanding that it is, as we say, biologically plausible. In other words, it is not stupid, not far-fetched. You could come up with a biological rationale that can explain how things go from generation to generation. And in the case of the licking and suckling paradigm we talked about there, they've shown that it lasts for at least 5 generations before it extinguishes itself. The question is the level of evidence that people like us putting on the table here, is that a high enough standard to make public policy on? Or is it simply something that raises a question that will excite people to a lot of conflict because it raises uncertainties that it can't answer, right? And, I mean, that's the question that I'm struggling with right now.
Well, 2 things come to mind for me. One is that our very strong traditional teaching says that whatever we do carries on for 7 generations. And that's a well-accepted belief in our communities. So I'm interested when you say 5, and we think 7, and who knows. And the other thing is that while the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is dealing strictly with the stories of survivors, throughout Aboriginal country, there's a desire and an interest and lots of initiatives to work with the several generations coming behind. I'm sure what you have to say would be really welcomed.
Maria, could I? Mm-hmm.
I'll get ready with
Clyde,
you.
Would it be fair to say that the question you raise is an empirically addressable question?
Yes, it definitely is. It probably won't be answered by the time the Truth and Reconciliation Commission shuts down, but it definitely is. It's a key question. I mean, once again, there are animal studies. But it's going to take a while to get the human studies done.
The next question concerns Holocaust survivors who have been studied in their first and second generations, the impacts later, and so we'll get an answer to that.
Darlene, there are no epigenetic data, human data yet, though, are there?
Hi, I've got one as a point. Working in clinical genetics, I think epigenetics will kind of give a different insight into what we can diagnose and what the implications of things are, and a lot of sort of multifactorial diseases that we don't quite understand yet. well, it's like heart disease and diabetes, and we see some different factors, but I think there's a lot more factors that probably are to do with epigenetics. But I also wanted to bring up, in one of the previous sessions, you mentioned the issue with obesity and maternal nutrition, and that maybe mothers that ate a lot of junk food and garbage, so their bodies were feeling more like they were starved, would produce babies that would become obese because they're basically developing, coming into a starvation environment. Did I get that right, or was that my imagination?
Are you asking me, or... In the previous session, you mean?
In the MiniMed a couple of years ago, when there was the CMMT group of sessions.
Yes, I think this was the nutrition session, which neither one of us was part of. So,
well, my understanding, anyways, was that if the mother, a lot of people now eat junk food that really has very little nutritional value, and that the baby then would come into, well, be developed in an environment that was lacking in nutrients, and that there would actually be an epigenetic change that would make it more susceptible to obesity because it's basically geared towards saving nutrition instead of, so that it would alter their metabolic rate.
So I can't speak to this specifically, but there is a really impressive animal study where the amount of vitamin B and folic acid and similar compounds actually determined the epigenetic makeup of the baby, and in a way that, as you described, that it lasted throughout life, and the babies that were born to moms that had very low vitamin B intake became diabetic, they became obese and such. To my knowledge, no such data is available for human, at least as far as the epigenetic goes, and Ray probably can speak much better to this in terms of the epidemiology.
There's very conflicting data. The only data that I think are generally accepted comes from a circumstance in which populations in which mothers have been underfed presumably create a circumstance where that the fetuses that survive the underfeeding have had a characteristic in them. I hate to use the term switched on because it implies the kinds of mechanisms we've been discussing tonight, and I'm not sure if the theory is there. But it may be that they become energy conservers, that you either convert them to energy conservers or you only select for the energy conservers, because only 30% of human conceptions get born. So there's a lot of selection going on. So if you select those fetuses which are more energy conserving because you yourself are starving, then there's some evidence that those infants then born into a calorically enriched environment get bigger faster and then had a higher risk of diabetes. That's the Barker hypothesis. Now, since that work has been done, there's been this kind of attempt to put that finding in the junk food era by arguing, well, these mothers could in fact be eating lots of calories, but they're not being well nourished, so the same phenomenon gets switched on. I mean, that's just pure speculation at this point. You know, it's an interesting proposition, but by the way, we have somebody in the audience who's more expert at this than perhaps than we are, Sylvia, but I think it's the case that there's really not any evidence, compelling evidence as yet, that junk food or poor nutrition creates the same mechanism that the Barker work suggests when you really do underfeed gravid females.
I've just noticed a pattern through the discussion and with Ray and with Clyde's argument that they're both coming to a sort of an understanding that these children are being born as blank slates. They are empty pieces of paper, and then all sorts of situations will happen, and it'll determine later on what the child's life will look like. And then Ray was saying, well, that's not true either, because no matter how many different words or letters you put on this blank slate, you will still get different values. And so where I'm coming from is sort of an energetic, I study energy healing and bringing in where, even before conception, what is this person supposed to be doing in their life, and how is their body interacting, and if they're subjected to poverty, if they're rich, what else is happening in this person's life that's sort of leading to these situations? And with the seven generations, we study that as well, that it is seven generations, that it happens forward and it happens backward. And so focusing on the healing, when one person heals, they heal seven generations forward, seven generations back. And so there's a lot of time and energy put into what are the determinants of health? What are the socioeconomic situations? It's blah, 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 blah. There's that other aspect is missing of how do we as a collective go in and do that healing for ourselves for seven generations forward, for seven generations back, and putting the responsibility back inwards.
My response is a reformed politician. I actually had a career in which I was a public official. As a professor, I thought I owed it to society to get into political life, and I did. I actually got elected as vice mayor of a city of 200,000 people in California. And what I learned pretty quickly was that the resolution, the creation of what we think of as just and sustainable societies, has to do with a conversation more like yours than like that we have. We're operating under the rules of science, for the most part. We're here to talk about what we really know about certain things. And what we really know about certain things isn't necessarily what leads us to do what we do as groups. In fact, oftentimes we probably don't want to know certain things about what humans are capable of. It might be better to just go on and govern ourselves without worrying about that. I wouldn't want us to govern every day thinking that we're capable of terrible things. That might lead us to do nothing. So I'm not so sure that the healing you're talking about is something that will follow from the kind of work that we do as scientists. It may be informed by what we say as citizens, and I'm hoping that as citizens, the four of us can say and speak the way any of you say and speak as citizens, what we think to be true. What we think to be true may be in part influenced by our science, but I'd be very much concerned that if you thought that the solutions for the policy and public debate about justice and well-being was going to come from science alone. I see this happening to some degree in other societies, not in Canada, but I've been to the UK and spent enough time there to know, for example, that if you make a proposition that something should change, the first question you're faced with is, what are the health effects? As if there were no adverse health effects, you could do anything you damn well please. And anything that you do that improves health is perfectly acceptable. And I'm troubled by that conversation. So that what you said to me makes perfectly good sense. In a Canadian society, you're having a debate about what happened to a subset of you, the way we have to have a debate about slavery in my country. I don't know that that debate should hang on research such as that we do.
Well, just a sec, if I could just say something. This isn't going to cross with race so much, but you started off saying that you saw me as being one of these tabula rasa people, that, you know, that child is a blank slate. I don't think that. I think what Tom was talking about, you know, that we're at this place now of understanding how nature and nurture work together. So I'm not a tabula rasa person. What I am is a population health researcher. So if over here I identify a population of 1,000 kids and only 30% of them, let's say, make it into adult life without having something really, really terrible go on, and over here there's a population where 80% get into adult life without anything really terrible happening, then I'm interested in the average difference in the conditions between the 30% and the 80% because I think it'll teach us something. So it's a methodology, right? So that's where I'm coming from.
First of all, I want to say thank you to you, Maria, and the panelists for a really interesting discussion and a lively one. And I have two, because I'm an especially curious human being, I have two questions. One is a kind of boring technical one for Michael. And I'm wondering about, you were talking about the actual mechanics of ground zero of nature-nurture. And I'm I keep coming across talking about methylation as the sort of primary activation of the epigenetic marks. And I'm wondering if you can help me understand that in a simple way, perhaps relating to something, a very simple real-world case. That's the boring technical question. And then for Ray, I have a lighthearted question and a very personal one. And I'm just wondering if, I'm guessing perhaps that you're something of a libertarian politically. No? Am I wrong?
I'm a very liberal Democrat, but in Canada, I suppose that makes me libertarian.
Yeah, well.
I'm a very liberal Democrat.
Okay, well then, maybe I'll withhold my question and my speculation is way off the mark. So I'll just leave it to Michael to.
Well, thanks for the compliments. You obviously are already an expert in epigenetics because methylation is sort of the keyword that is being thrown around left, right, and center. And methylation really refers to, when most people use it, it refers to an addition of a small chemical group, a methyl group, to the DNA, and that can have profound influences on, as I mentioned earlier, whether the gene is turned on or turned off, in that what happens is that, generally speaking, and this is sort of the textbook figure, although that's being rewritten as we speak in many cases, what's happening, if you have one of these methyl groups in the regulatory regions of a gene attached to the DNA, it ultimately creates a structure of packaging of the DNA that is non-conducive to the gene being turned on. So that's basically the mechanistic idea. And the reason you hear a lot about methylation, rather than say there's, you know, if you look at the textbook, there are probably 100 other modifications that can do the same and often act together in concert with methylation. It's really a technical issue, and that is that methylation is really the easiest to measure, and we like to measure easy things. but there is much more to regulating the gene, that dimming of the gene than methylation, but it is the one that's most prominent right now, so you have been following the literature quite carefully.
Hi there. I was wondering if there were any studies that looked at epigenetic markers of the children of immigrants versus the population in the home countries.
Not yet.
or any suggestive evidence.
No, it's not a boring suggestion.
No, it's
not. Yeah. You know, if I could just say, the number of human studies so far that do those kind of comparisons, that type or the type that we've done with high and low socioeconomic kids and so forth, is very small. Like, there might be a couple of dozen around the world. And I think part of the reason for that is that the vast majority of people who are working in the epigenetic area are working on mechanism, right? And so, in a sense, I mean, it's interesting, Vancouver, in a way, is starting to turn into a bit of a focal point for asking population questions about epigenetics because of the array of forces that we've recruited here into the Vancouver research community. You know, we have a number of studies going on now that promise to get at questions like that faster than a lot of other places in the world.
So would you like people to send their questions to you?
Yes, right.
So you've got research for the next 20 years. Tom, did you want to say something?
Oh, I was just going to add that far from being a boring question or proposal, it's really key, because we know from epidemiologic studies that sometimes we can get at key questions that can be only looked at in immigrant populations. So, for example, a couple of examples that come to mind are Lynn Syme's work at Berkeley, where he looked at coronary heart disease in Japanese people who were stayed in Japan, those who moved to Hawaii, and those who moved to California, and was able to show a graded influence on cardiovascular disease among those three immigrant or non-immigrant populations. And another one that's well known is the immigration of Latino people into North America and into the United States, and the gradual decrease in health status as they stay within non-Latino societies within North America over time. So there are key immigrant questions that really ought to be addressed at the epigenetic level. We're about the business of trying to bring together the laboratory scientists and the population scientists to answer those kinds of questions.
So you'd go back and ask the question, what's different? What's different beyond what we're seeing? Why are those differences different? That's the question.
Yeah, and if I can just make one more point, actually, and Tom is extremely modest and so is Leb, but Tom actually is a natural incubator of ideas, so he actually initiated, and together with Clyde, and one of the studies that we're setting out to do now is to actually go into different cultures to compare the epigenetic makeup of the children as it relates to socioeconomic gradients, as it relates to their environment. So one study that the three of us are actually engaged in is with the Aga Khan University in Pakistan to do similar interrogations, and with folks down in Latin America to really sort of get the cross-cultural view of how, you know, different environments might translate onto the imprint onto the genome by epigenetic means.
Thanks for a really interesting discussion. I just wanted to make a comment earlier about the mothers that are heavier and whether they're infants become heavier. And we know there's a body of research that looks at how many fat cells we're born with, and that if we're born with more fat cells, then it's harder for us to be leaner. But then we bring in the determinants of health, and if you're born with a personality that likes to move a lot, even if you have a lot of fat cells, it doesn't matter because you can't stop moving. If you're born with a personality that is not a mover and a shaker, then having a lot of fat cells, it makes it more difficult. So it really goes along with the research of we have these genetics, but yet the personality that we're born with, whether those genetics are expressed in a certain way, will determine our health status. One of the things that, while listening to you, and I was like listening to whether in the first 3 years of life our genetics can change, I'm not using the right words, but then as we get older, maybe they're not so placid, is that?
Plastic,
yeah. Yeah. So, but what I'm wondering is that it doesn't really make sense if you actually look at nature, because we've evolved through hundreds of thousands of years with our environment causing that evolution. So in nature, it makes sense that we would have our whole life to make those genetic evolutionary changes. Would it not? And the second question being, with our lifespan, is it the age that the mothers are conceiving? Does that make the big difference in the lifespan of the child? Like, we are conceiving at 35 and 40, whereas before we were conceiving at 15. Is that making a big difference in the genetic changes of and how they're expressed? So I know those are two separate questions, but...
Well, first off, I think we will have done the audience a disservice if people go out of the meeting tonight thinking that we were talking about genetic changes. The point of the epi in epigenetic is very important, that it's not about changing the sequence of the, but it's about things that change the capacity to express, okay? In terms of your question, your question about evolution, I think it's a very good one, and I once you get involved with epigenetics, you have to be thinking in evolutionary terms. And one of the things that seems to be tricky about evolutionary terms, though, is that it seems to be possible to make a whole bunch of different kinds of arguments in retrospect as to what makes evolutionary sense, right? One of the things, though, that I think you can't argue with is the following, that even back in the bad old days when girls were having kids at 15, or maybe it was the good old days, I don't know. Still, the point from the time of birth till the time they were having the kids, 15 years, would be going through 15 summer, spring, fall, winters, going through possible famines, etc., etc. In other words, the generation time for human species is very long compared to environmental change, which can occur across seasons or things like that. So the demand for plasticity of the epigenetic sort, you can really see the evolutionary reason that there would be that if, in fact, the point of evolution is to get the female as far as she can reproduce or something like that, right? As opposed to, say, the fruit fly, which, you know, will turn over in a day, right? And there, the difference is there's no epigenetics. It's just genetic differences. And, you know, presumably what happens is you've got a bunch of different genetic phenotypes or genotypes that come out here, and if the environment changes, okay, this 60% gets knocked off, but within, you know, 3 hours, this 40% are going to be breeding like bunny rabbits, whereas for humans, with that much larger period, there has to be plasticity in there. So I think we can understand the rationale for early plasticity, right? In terms of what you would say occurs after the time that reproduction occurs, I don't know. I don't know that there's a strong evolutionary selection on that end.
There's controversy here. I think most of the both the evolutionary theorists and the mathematicians who do the important work will show you that most
that's why they pay them the big bucks.
What we know about actual human evolution, driven in the classic Darwinian sense, occurs primarily in utero, because that's where you lose the human population in fractions large enough to actually change the physical characteristics of them. It's been a long... We don't have any history of humans dying at a high enough rate between birth and reproductive age to create the changes we know have occurred in the in the species. So it's generally accepted that that's why we have long gestation, because it's in gestation where we make selections on what humans ought to be to fit the environment. Where Clyde and I agree is that, of course, because humans have a relatively long period between their birth and their reproductive age, that the guessing about what the environment's going to be like for that period is oftentimes wrong. Mm. So what you try to do when you what you try to select for is the capacity to adjust to what the environment is. So there is plasticity in humans. They can be influenced, obviously, late in gestation and in early life, and that's what we're talking about. So make no mistake, I mean, you can change human populations by the environments they occupy. We know that. The question we're debating and trying to understand is how profound and deep that change is, and therefore how autoregressive it is. That is, does it really last beyond one generation? Now, I'm not an expert in this field, but I know the literature, and the literature suggests there's great controversy about how long these epigenetic effects persist. So that's yet to be settled. But I think we need to be careful here about plasticity in humans. We know that there's a good functional reason why they're plastic, and we know they're plastic to some degree. But we can't argue that that plasticity is essential to our understanding of our evolution. In fact, because it's not. It's neither theoretically nor mathematically necessary. It's helpful. But humans are as they are, mainly because of what's happened to us in gestation. To this day, in the most benign of societies, we still lose more than 70% of the conceptions. And no one will argue that 30 that get born are representative of the 100 that were conceived. That there's an obvious selection against those who are not going to be the good transmitters of maternal genes from time t to time t plus n. And that's true in every species, and that's true in humans. Every species that produces a surplus of zygotes, as we do, does that because you're going to select against certain characteristics and for others. And what we need to worry about, it seems to me, is through what we do to ourselves collectively, are we creating probabilities for either plasticity or for selection, which we'd rather not do? Most of the conversation tonight is about environments that will get us something that we want. I'm worried about that. What I think we can agree on is some things we don't want. We don't want monsters. We don't want people that we would not be proud of as being humans. And maybe that's what we should be thinking about, rather than saying, I know the ideal human, and I know how to create him or her. I'm troubled by that. But I can't deny that, of course, there's a profound effect of the environment, particularly late in gestation and early in human life, on what we are.
It's interesting. I didn't hear anybody say that they were going to create the ideal human. I heard a lot of talk about changing the environment to accommodate whatever it is we discover
Let's get a little excitement here. If you just say what we said, we'll all fall asleep.
I don't know a lot because I did grow up in a small town.
But I love that statement. I grew up in a small town, and I still can think. There you go. You violated your own theory.
And this is being recorded.
Well, I think what you're saying is we're all success stories because we made it to conception, right?
That's right.
I'm still blown away by the fact that somehow we know, quote unquote, when the baby is in here, that we know that child would survive or not.
Well, the fact is we don't know, but what we do know over large populations and lots of observations over periods of time is that we don't typically create humans that aren't going to survive. We try not to, meaning the biology of humanity, tries not to create humans in which we're going to invest a lot of time and effort, particularly on behalf of the mother, and therefore deplete her capacity to tend to siblings and to future children in order to invest in an infant that cannot reproduce. Mm-hmm. And, for example, the classic is the Turner syndrome thing. There's this one kind of funny deal that gets through the filter in which you produce offspring that can't reproduce. And that's the one mechanism that we kind of understand how that happens. And in understanding how that happened, we learned about why a lot of other things don't happen. It's the hiding of that characteristic by a little protein. So we know that the biology of humans is to produce, not to have that happen. The same way we know that that's true of plants. So, we are like other living things. So that's part of what we do.
Yeah. All right. So I know that you're not in the business of guessing what's going to happen in the future, but when a lot of us read about epigenetics, I start to wonder what's the world going to be like if, in fact, you get answers to the questions that you're asking. Do you think that way? Do you have an idea about where these... And the other sense I'm getting, by the way, is that this is very early stages. Clyde, what you said actually is fairly profound, that in Vancouver alone, here, with this conglomeration here of people, you're actually connecting more to that basic cellular research to the real world than probably a lot of other places in the world. That's exciting. That's for the filmmaker. That's a good story. So just that little glimmer that you're getting, are you allowed as scientists to think about where might we be 10 years from now with these questions?
We're on so early in the growth trajectory of this field that 10 years from now, I think we may have gotten beyond looking only at methylation because it's the easiest thing to do. But I wouldn't anticipate that in 10 years there would be, profound revolutions in how we think about human societies or how we do parenting. Or 30 years from now, I guess my dream would be that while I don't think we can ever anticipate that human societies will not be stratified, I think that's part of that's an evolutionarily conserved feature of who we are as creatures, just as it is in fruit flies and non-human primates and rats and so on. It's going to be with us. It's part of who we are. But perhaps we will begin to be able to create societies where there's a greater disconnect between one's location on a human hierarchy and one's health and well-being and satisfaction with life and the ability to enjoy life like the Danes.
Well, in 10 years, I think that we will know the answer to a few really interesting questions. For instance, I think we will know across a range of populations whether or not there is some sort of a epigenetic signature, which is the word that Michael used, that relates to certain kinds of social conditions. Is there an epigenetic signature that, say, is associated with early abuse and neglect, or early abuse is one and neglect is another? Is there a graded signature of socioeconomic deprivation which cuts across society in some ways? Are there patterns that are entirely bounded by certain cultures or things that generalize across cultures and so forth? I think we will have a fair amount of information about those things. What I'm afraid of is that will be the place that the science will be at, but the place that the kitsch will be at will be somewhere else. Mm. You know? Well, already people are talking about the epigenetic pills, right? Like, there will be an awful lot of commercial production of neuroses in order to sell you something to take the neuroses away, right? And I think there's absolutely no question that that's going to go on, right? That there's going to be a lot of that. Yeah. And, for instance, as it stands right now, with the fact that everybody carries lethal genes means that, there's lots of marketing now of, like, finding out what's wrong with you, that sort of thing. So I'm afraid that there will be that whole new industry, and I think it's almost inevitable that there will be. But I'm also optimistic that this kind of thing that we're talking about, which is to use these things to understand more about the nature of human beings as a social species and as a species within their environment, will also be moving forward in a positive way, and that we will learn some things out of that can have some unequivocal positives. And I would say that the unequivocal positives are in the sense that Ray kind of riffed on at the end there, that it isn't so much about producing ideals or going in that direction, but being able to really understand in a pretty systematic way what the things that are really bad to do are, right? I think, we could do a lot of good by figuring out a few bad things and not doing them.
Bad things that stick.
Yeah, bad things that stick. That's right.
It's hard to predict 10 years. I have hopes rather than predictions. My hope is that we will learn enough so that, for example, being poor won't mean you'll be sicker. But I still hope that if I come to Canada, I'll find Canadians as mad and troubled by the fact that you have a big difference between rich and poor, or that we have even a bigger one, that simply because you took away the health effects doesn't make it the right thing.
A fine thought on which to end, but of course I question whether we actually need to have a distinction between rich and poor. The uncut versions of the panel discussion are available for download at unwelcomeguest.net/527. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you have.